The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast January 28th, 2025.
Do you remember sweet Betsy from Pike? Crossed the big mountains with her lover Ike. With two yoke of oxen, a big yaller dog, a tall Shanghai rooster, and one spotted hog. Poodle dang fal de dido.
All right, good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked, where we are going to take the Oregon Trail today with my guest, Todd Krickmer.
Hi, Priscilla. Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
All right. And the book is Scout of the Oregon Trail, the story of an American family traveling the Oregon Trail in 1852, as told by Scout, the family dog. And I started with Sweet Betsy from Pike because her story has some things in common with this one, particularly that it's, you know, I don't know if you know that song, but the song is kind of intended to be funny, but it's not all funny. The animals die. Betsy lies down in despair in the desert, and Ike says, "Betsy, get up, you'll get sand in your eyes," you know, which is a kind of a nice balance between, characteristic of this book, between the perils and dangers and the joy and the adventures. Okay. End of preamble. Todd Krickmer is a retired CPA. He spent more than 30 years developing his natural love and talent for storytelling. He's a former scoutmaster with both Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, a school volunteer, and a youth group chaperone. This is his first book, and it's an extension of his love for storytelling. Do you want to add anything about yourself?
Well, I don't know, Priscilla, that's pretty good. I like the way you wrap that up. Yes, I was technically a scoutmaster with the Boy Scouts, but I was also an active volunteer in Girl Scouts, and the girls always love to hear my stories around the campfire. So.
All right. Well, this is an extended story about and around campfires, I guess. I usually try to do a quick summary for listeners so they'll know what the book is about. It is 1852. Stuart and Mattie Churchill and their three children, Josh and Sarah, who are teenagers, and Molly, who is only six, are waiting in St. Louis for the spring, the weather to change, so they can start the 2,000, Wikipedia said 2,100 miles, the conversation in your book says 2,400, but anyway, the journey to Oregon. The kids get money for candy, but instead they buy a dog for two bits. And Scout, the dog, tells the story of their journey in a whole series of chapters. Each chapter covers a section of the trail. And we get some really exciting adventures because Scout is so happy to have been adopted and given a name, never had one before, that Scout does everything possible to protect the family and to... And there's a lot of detail about, I felt like I really had a feeling for the experience of the journey. Anything to add to a summary?
No, I think that was awesome. That's great. Yeah, they would typically gather in St. Louis and wait for the spring thaw, because of course the Great Plains would be frozen over.
Yeah.
Before they could begin their journey.
Yeah, it's a pretty big leap. I mean, in some ways, writing this book is a natural extension of telling stories, but it's one thing to tell a 10-minute story around a campfire, and another to write a 250-page novel. So, how did you come to make that transition?
Well, I probably have had this story in my head since I was a kid, but I think I was, as a kid, I enjoyed the concept of writing, but I was a terrible, terrible writer. I didn't particularly have good handwriting, and I'm a horrible speller. I was dyslexic as a child. I'm pretty much over it now. At least, hopefully, my tax clients have gotten away with it. And but with the advent of the word processor, it just became easier and easier. Of course, I typed in business and for business letters and business reports, and it, as my retirement became inevitable, I started writing more and more for pleasure. The mm-hmm. word processor made it possible. It was the tool I needed to unleash the writer inside of me.
Oh, it's nice to hear that. So when you say you were a terrible writer, you just mean the physical act of writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, physical act of writing. Yeah. I had the stories in my head,
yeah,
but physically writing them out was very painful.
Yeah, I've always had terrible handwriting myself, so I fully sympathize. Okay, so why? a book about the Oregon Trail. You say you've had it in your head since you were a kid?
Yeah, I think so. I am native of California, and my great-great-grandfather was a 49er. So how he got out to California in the 1850s, I don't know. I don't know if he did it overland or by sea. I'm not sure. We're still doing family research to try to figure that out. But so I have a connection to California. When I first started the concept of the book, I couldn't decide whether Oregon, California. I ended up doing Oregon because it's more common in the vernacular. More people are familiar with it, at least the term Oregon mm-hmm. Trail than they are California mm-hmm. Trail. So anyway, it ended up being Oregon.
Yeah. And it's because, and okay, so why does the dog get to tell the story?
Well, okay, so that's what I make presentations to schools and libraries, and when I tell the kids, of course I have a PowerPoint slideshow, but when I tell the kids, I had this story again as a child, and I think it came about back when the 50s and 60s, when I was growing up, it was TV was all black and white, and the staple of TV was Westerns. Well, there was Westerns, you know, half the programming on TV was Westerns.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Including Wagon Train. Now, we weren't particularly Wagon Train family. That wasn't one of our favorite shows. But I remember it, and I remember seeing the dog always had to walk. The poor dog, you know, always had to walk the whole 2,000 miles. And lo and behold, we didn't know this until Sherry and I, my wife and I started tracking. We drove the Oregon Trail. We learned that everybody walked. Everybody walked. But we didn't know that. You know, I didn't know that as a kid because on Hollywood, everybody rides in the wagon. Well, that's not true. Nobody rode in the wagon. But I didn't know that until I started doing research.
Mm-hmm. So you were focused on the dog because the dog got to walk and see everything?
Yeah, because I felt sorry for the poor dog. And I also, once we moved to here to Central Texas, and I've heard stories about before the cedar trees covered the hills here, the grass was, before there was cedars covered everything here in Central Texas, it was grassland. Mm-hmm. And the grass, as they said, the old expression goes, the grass was belly high on a horse. Well, that meant if the grass was belly high on a horse, the dog would only be able to see the trail ahead of him.
Right.
And I got thinking about that, like, well, again, not only did the poor dog have to walk and avoid getting run over by a wagon, the dog could only see what was ahead of him. So I had that perspective of, well, what would the dog see? What would the trip be like for mm-hmm. a dog?
Yeah, I picked up on that when I read it. And also because everything was new to the dog, so the dog had to describe everything.
Yes.
Because the people, of course, would know what a wagon brake was like.
Yeah.
You know, but the sniff, sniff to the dog.
The dog wouldn't know.
It's a new thing.
And the dog didn't know what Oregon was or where they were going or why they were going. So the dog has to hear all these explanations, and I do that through human dialogue mm-hmm. that the dog overhears.
Yeah. Yeah. How far did you get to try to create a dog's consciousness? I mean, I remember a moment when there's actually a mountain lion. I mean, we don't see the mountain lion, but and Scout thinks it smells like the stray cats I knew in St. Louis, but different.
Right.
You know.
Right, because Scout had not seen a mountain lion, but Scout sees the footprints and smells that, my gosh, that smells like a cat, mm-hmm. but I've never seen a cat like that before.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, talk some more about how you, I mean, did you sit there and try to think, what does it feel like to be a dog, or is the dog really kind of a person in a way?
Well, the dog doesn't speak to animals or to people, but the dog types beautifully. So, it was hard to keep the concept of I'm writing for the dog. I tried to do that the best I could because, again, what would the dog know? The dog wouldn't know where Oregon is, or the dog wouldn't know why we were taking this trip. But So I tried to, what would the dog know? And the dog only learns things through experiences, through either seeing it or hearing it, humans talk about it.
Right, direct. Do you consider this, you said you read passages, and we'll have you read it a little later, but you read passages to schools. Do you consider this a children's book?
Yes, but primarily because it's told from a dog's point of view. Mm-hmm. And I realize there are adult books that are told from a dog's point of view also, like Learning to Drive in the Rain. and which is popular recently. I think my overall intention, because working with kids for so long and enjoying working with kids, I'm trying to get children, young adults, to appreciate American history as much as I appreciate American history, and I'm doing it in a way that makes it exciting and accessible. If they get to read, I agree the story's fictional, but if they read a fictional family making an actual trip, because tens of thousands of people made this trip.
70,000 in 1852.
Yes, 1852 was a big year. Yeah. That's right. If I can get children, young adults, and middle grade, it's actually for middle grade. The book's intended for 9 to 14-year-olds, but of course anyone can read it. If I can get them excited about American history, or if I can just teach them some American history in a fun, interesting way, then I think that's my goal.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to tell you, when I started reading this, I thought, I wish history had been like this when I was in school. You know, I was sort of the era of, oh, it seemed like dates and wars.
Right.
You know, and so I'm sure I must have been told about the Oregon Trail, but with nothing like this kind of immediacy so that I could identify with what was going on.
And too many white males.
And there's that too, you know. And reading it as an adult, that was what I liked. Like why you need a wagon with a brake, and what happens, and how much. You mean you even have that list of the supplies that they took, and so it makes you. Maybe it's after years of living and coping with the physical world, just to survive. And to see that going on for this family, you know, I really enjoyed that. How did you do the research for this?
Well, I started reading books on the Oregon Trail, not specifically textbooks or history books, but just books where people told stories of the Oregon Trail, and that got me more and more interested. And then we decided to, it was kind of a bucket list item for me to drive the Oregon Trail. So we have a travel trailer, and we took our dogs. And so with the travel trailer, we went to St. Louis, and we hung out in St. Louis for a couple of days and did the museum there underneath the arch, which is Gateway to the West.
Yeah, I've been in there once years ago. It was wonderful.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful museum. And then from there, we drove the freeway to Independence, Missouri, which is actually where most of the trail kicks off from. And then from Independence, you have maps. AAA on their state maps, the trail is visible. You can see the trail, the Oregon Trail, the California Trail, the Mormon Trail, and the Pony Express Trail. Were all basically the same trail, and they're detailed on the map, on the AAA maps, until you get to the Rocky Mountains, and then the trails split up after the Rocky Mountains. But the National Park Service also prints a map, and they print a turn-by-turn map that you can put on your electronic device, or you can get the fold-out version of it, and you can follow it that way. A lot of the trail's paved over, but there's still quite a bit of trail that's not.
So what did you see on this trip that got into the book?
Oh, well,
was there anything, or was it just to think about it?
Yeah, the book was my original concept was the book was going to be 36,000 words, and it's now 52,000 because the more we drove, we stopped at museums every single day, literally, and so the more we learned, the more got into the book, and I wasn't going to put in this thing. I wasn't going to put in this thing. I wasn't going to put in this thing. Well, after we stood there and stood on the ground and looked around, I thought, well, I got to put this in. And we learned more interesting stories and more details about the wagons, more details about the oxen, why they used oxen. And so much of our understanding of the westward migration is from Hollywood. And even though that's certainly interesting and certainly one of my original concepts of the trail, so much of Hollywood is incorrect. It's written, I don't know why, it's not accurate. And one of the big accuracies is, first, the wagons were pulled by oxen. Mm-hmm. And Hollywood doesn't show that because oxens are stupid and slow and lumbering, and so horses are more exciting. Well, no one used a horse. You couldn't use a horse. A horse couldn't pull a wagon that far.
Yeah.
But oxen can. Mm-hmm. So we learned that, and that got added to the book. And other spots where we visited, and I said, well, I didn't even know about this. And we stood in wagon ruts in Wyoming, there's a spot, it's a state historical spot where you can park and get out and walk. That wagon ruts are 5 feet deep. You can stand in wagon ruts 5 feet deep. When you think about that, the hundreds of thousands of wagons that rolled over that rock to create that those wagon ruts.
And they were heavy. Some of them carried, you know, all of these people's belongings.
Plus
all this food that they, flour and stuff that they had to
That's
have.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite inspiring.
Yeah. So that, that I skipped a question that I wanted to ask you. Is Scout based on a real dog?
Very, very, very loosely.
Oh, okay.
The book is dedicated to our Scout. Mm-hmm. Our Scout was, every family has that one dog, you know, and Scout was our one dog. Mm-hmm. She was a Golden Lab Retriever mix, and she was the sweetest dog we ever owned. Okay. And so, yes, and her name was Scout. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, some of the book is, she was somewhat a dead, I wasn't really sure what to name the dog at first. And my daughter goes, Dad, the dog's name is Scout. And I went, oh, yeah, you're right, you're right.
Okay. And I wondered if you, I mean, you already kind of talked about it with there's the Hollywood image in which the dog walks, as although we know that now the people walk, partly because the wagons were so rough.
Yes.
Know? I mean, that's what you point out in here, is that it was miserable unless you were just too weak or sick to walk for some reason.
Right. The wagons were unsprung, and most of them did not have seats, and most of them did not have brakes. You were on an unpaved road. Rock road with iron rimmed wheeled wagons with no springs. You couldn't ride in the wagon. You'd be jolted to death, and so no one did. Everyone walked.
Yeah. So what do you know about actual dogs on the trail? I forgot to warn you that I like to read from the book under discussion as well. And we start with Scout, and it looks like this kind of disreputable, maybe he's a drunk or something, in St. Louis, Scout thinks of him as smelly, because he doesn't probably smell worse than any of us dogs. And he's rounded up these dogs and is selling them or trying to sell them to people going out west. You folks headed out west? Yes, sir, the little girl said. He appeared before her brother shushed her. Yes, sir, says the teenage boy. We're headed out west this spring, as soon as the trail dries out. And then he says, well then, you're going to need a dog, a good strong dog, a dog that can keep you safe on the trail out west. The kids just stared at him, so he added, every wagon needs a good dog, a dog for protection, a dog for hunting, a dog for scouting the trail out ahead of you. And, of course, Scout adds to this by going up, wagging the tail, and, you know, I think he even licks the little girl a couple of times. So that kind of cinches it. But were you able to find out anything about the role of dogs on this journey?
Well,
or did you make it up?
Yes, it's partly fiction, but the you can see in photographs and in paintings there were dogs. People did have dogs. In journals I read, the dogs didn't always make it. It was 2,000 miles, and that's a long trek for a dog. But there were families with dogs. I don't think every family had a dog. I'm not even sure they were common, but they were there. They was common enough that some people had dogs, and it was probably just their family dog or their barn, you know, their farm dog.
Of the guy rounding up the strays and selling them is,
well,
you know,
that's fictional.
That's very creative.
Yeah, that was.
And it could happen. I would think
it could happen. I mean, yes, the guy was the equivalent of a modern day homeless person, and instead of begging, which wouldn't have been very profitable in those days, he gets the dogs for free, just catches them, puts a rope around their neck, and he tries to sell them, and he's getting 25 cents. Well, he's getting 2 bits. The reason they're 2 bits is because I was trying to, expose the kids to the old concept of 25 cents was called 2 bits, because 2 bits is, you know, a quarter of a dollar.
Yeah, I always wondered about that, because there's never been a coin that was a bit.
Well, there was. You know. The doubloon was 8 pieces. The doubloon was divided into 8 pieces. That's why you got 8 bits. And so, because before there was U.S. currency, there were Spanish doubloons. Spanish doubloons were typically divided into eighths. You could cut them into eighths. So 2 bits, an eight would, you know, 1 bit would be 6.5 cents. Well, 2 bits would be, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, it's 12 and a half cents. So 2 bits would be a quarter.
Oh, I always wondered. I mean, I knew a quarter was 2 bits, but I never knew why. All right.
Well, so if you could read the footnote in the book, then.
I probably did, but I might have forgotten. All right, we are, believe it or not, up on our first break.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
Get ready, San Marcos. 104.1 KZSM presents the second annual San Marcos Music Awards. Become a member today and nominate your favorite San Marcos music artists, venues, and more. Nominations are open till Monday, January 13th, and members-only voting is open January 15th through the 19th. Finalists will be voted on by the public January 21st through 28th, and the San Marcos Music Awards ceremony will be held on January 31st at the Historic Price Center with the red carpet starting at 6 p.m. Come show your support for our local music scene as the community names this year's winners of the SMMAs. General admissions includes 5 food and drink tickets, raffles, giveaways, vendors, and VIP packages available. Sponsored by Listed San Marcos, The Price Center, Gumby's, Big Man Kitchen, Miracle Leaf, Kit Massage, Twin Liquors, and What's On Your Mind Design. Tickets and memberships available at kzsm.org/smma.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked, where I have here, speaking of the San Marcos Music Awards, 2 tickets to the San Marcos Music Awards to give away. So if you come by the studio during the show at 216 North Guadalupe, they're sitting here waiting for you. And today we are taking recalling a really wonderful journey in the book Scout of the Oregon Trail by Todd Krickmer, and he's here to talk to me about it, which I very much appreciate. So another question. One more thing. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the host and guest only and not those of KZSM or its parent corporation, SMTX CRA. One more question. I really liked the way I wish I had history more like this when I was in school. And one of the things you do is you work in a conversation so that we know why the Churchills and other people are doing this. I mean, what a thing to do, you know, take everything you own and travel 2,000 difficult miles. Stuart Churchill says, "We're from Vermont, 4 generations dated back to the American Revolution. We owned a 40-acre farm, but we're totally hemmed in. I couldn't afford to buy more acres, and I couldn't feed my family on the rocky 40 acres we had. Our family has farmed that plot of land for over 100 years, and I still harvested more rocks each year than anything marketable. It's all I could do to feed my family, and I want more for them than that. In Oregon, the government will guarantee us 640 acres of fertile farmland." And that was it. "I don't have to farm at all. I just have to homestead it." So did you want to comment on...
my family, Churchill is a family name. My great-great-grandmother was a Churchill, and she was from Vermont. So that's the connection there, I guess. They owned a farm, and actually the family still owns the farm. It's still there, mm-hmm. even though I'm not in... touch with those that branch of my family. But it was that the people, I would make the point that the people that made this trip westward, the westward expansion, the vast majority of them were not poor. The Churchills were middle class people.
Yeah, you can tell that. I mean, they have enough money to buy a good quality wagon. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an investment, but it's an important one. And they've been corresponding with a wagon master, but when Stuart meets him, he doesn't like him. He says, the guy drinks, and I don't mind somebody having a drink, but I don't want to make this journey with a drunk.
Right.
You know, so he finds another wagon master who perhaps might be more expensive since he's mm-hmm. a professional. So I wondered about that, you know, where did the money come from? And were these, and you were, as you were just explaining, there's so middle class was typical?
Yeah, I think middle class was typical. I mean, there might have been some families that were, you know, approaching bankruptcy and driven off their farms and, you know, just out of desperation headed west. But it was very expensive, very, very expensive. You had to buy a wagon. You had to buy the livestock. If you were already in the Midwest and you were being driven off your farm, well, you might have a wagon. You might already have livestock. But if you were coming from further away, you wouldn't. And so that meant you had to buy that. You had to buy 5 to 6 months worth of supplies. You had to buy everything in what was now modern-day Kansas City. It wasn't called Kansas City. It was called Westport back then. But either Westport or Independence or St. Joseph, Missouri, which was the other jumping-off point. You had to buy everything there. It wasn't particularly cheap. It was a lot cheaper there than trying to buy it on the trail, because if you had stopped at these trading posts along the trail, yeah, it was much more expensive. But so that meant you had to do the best you could. You had to buy a guidebook. You had to, if possible, you had to hire a professional trail wagon master. Now, I might add, most wagon trains did not hire a professional guide. Most elected their own, and they called them the captain. They would elect mm-hmm. their own captain, because generally the wagon trains were 40 to 50 wagons at a time. But that's what happened to the Donner Party. The Donner Party, and that was in 1846, but they elected their own wagon, their captain. Mm. Mr. Donner was the captain, when you probably know what happened to them. So that wasn't always the, you know, the smartest thing to do. And Stuart Churchill mentions that he's a farmer. He's not, you know, he doesn't yeah. know how to cross a continent. So he feels more comfortable hiring someone.
Yeah, and he says that because I think it's his wife who questions him. I can't find the passage, but he says something like, you know, we're farmers, we're artisans, we don't know anything about doing this. Mm-hmm. You know, it's better to have someone along who does. And I love the character of the wagon master, actually.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Mr. Lassiter?
Mr. Lassiter, yeah. He says, well, I've made two trips so far and never lost anybody. That turns out not to be true on this trip.
No.
In the there's a tent city in Independence, which is where they take a steamship from St. Louis to Independence, and in Independence they are mm-hmm. gathering the wagons, and they encounter families from all over. Scout's description is kind of liked. There were people of every age, and many of them did not speak English. I didn't know where they came from, but they cooked different foods with many new and unrecognized smells, and I like that. Says the dog is dog-like, understandably focused on food. Did you research the demographic? Sounds like you already did. The composition of the people who took the trail. Were there a lot of immigrants? There's a scene where the Churchill kids defend a German boy who is being bullied as a foreigner.
Right.
You know.
Yes, that's a scene where Scout starts to prove its worth as a protection from the family, because the mother, Maddie, she wasn't particularly crazy about them buying a dog. And like she said, it's just another mouth to feed, which Scout, of course, liked the sound of that. But
yeah.
But Scout realizes the circumstances of its adoption. And so Scout is determined that, you know, I'm going to be the best darn dog any family ever had. And every chance Scout got to prove it, Scout would do something heroic. And I'm not trying, you know, there's no Timmy fell into the well, but it's similar in the same
yeah.
concept that,
yeah.
you know, once Sarah tries to defend the teenage girl, tries to defend this German boy who's being picked on, she gets picked on herself. She gets pushed into the mud. Well, Scout doesn't like that. And Scout, you know, attacks the bully.
Yeah.
Until Ma comes and pulls Scout off the boy's. Scout knocks the kid into the mud onto his back, and it stands over him growling until Ma pulls him off. Well, Ma starts to realize, well, maybe Scout is a good dog. Maybe this is a good investment.
And this happens throughout.
Almost every chapter.
Yeah, that Scout does something to protect or help the family, and the parents gradually come to be as fond of Scout as the kids are.
Right.
Really. As a matter of fact, I think I want to ask you now kind of about the Churchill family dynamic, because you kind of touched on that. They're a very functional family, but it's not without tension, you know.
Right.
Like, oh, the kid's came home with his dog. But significantly, and this is kind of typical of the family, they apparently decide, well, the kid spent their money, they got the dog, if the kids take care of the dog, you know, that's up to them. And all of the family members seem to, they give each other some autonomy. I mean, they care and protect one another, but they also give each other space. So there's a nice scene when they're boarding the steamship, they're listing who's on the manifest. "I see that," the man said, "but it doesn't say anything here about a dog. Whose dog is this?" "Well, it's our dog," Molly loudly exclaimed. "The dog ain't on my manifest, lady. So if it's another 10 cents, if you want to take the dog." 10 cents, Josh exclaimed. Looking around for his father to help, he saw that Pa was still busy with the luggage. Glancing at his mother, Josh realized she wasn't going to be any help either. Recognizing it was up to him to solve the matter of my fare, he said, "Mister, it's just a dog. It's our dog, and it can't possibly cost an additional 10 cents for a dog." "Nothing rides for free, son. Every person pays, every piece of cargo, and yes, every animal pays. Dogs are no exception. So if the dog is going, it's 10 cents. And the man holds out his hand. And then Josh does something which he has done before when the dog was being bought, and says, "Sarah, give me a dime." And Sarah, for some reason, always has a little stash of money. And so, I looked up to catch the expression on Ma's face and was relieved to see that she was smiling. I realized she considered me to be Josh, Sarah, and Molly's dog. She was pleased that they had worked out the problem of me boarding the boat by themselves. And that's kind of how this family operates.
Right.
So were you consciously kind of trying to, maybe not a model family, because they're not like a Hallmark card, but, you know, trying to make them a good family for, you know, kids.
Yes, I'm trying to develop a personality for each of the characters. Uh-huh. Josh is a teenage boy, probably 16 years old, 15 or 16 years old, getting ready to strike out on his own. He's a very hard worker. He minds his parents, but he's of that age where he's somewhat independent, or beginning to become independent. He's also not very good with money. And
no.
There's several instances where he is penniless and he looks to his sister for money. And Sarah is she's the one of the family, of the three children. She's the one that's entrepreneurial, more sensible, better at handling mm-hmm. money. And Josh knows that. And when he's broke and needs money, he knows that he can probably get it from, unless his mom and pop stop him, he can hit Sarah up for it.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm asking is, did you consciously think, I'm going to make this a good functional family that people can admire, although you don't call attention to that, like, oh, what a great family this is. But when you read it, you can think, oh, okay. And I was wondering if you were thinking of this as kind of a model family, or, I mean, if it's a book for young kids, you know, did you consciously think, oh, this would be good for kids to read, a family that works like this?
Yeah, well, I think siblings are always different. I know I have two brothers, and my God, the three of us, we could not be more different. My wife sitting over here, she has three siblings, and the four of them, they couldn't possibly be more different from each other. And I think I'm trying to portray that siblings, even my own kids, you know, they certainly had they were loyal to each other. They were faithful siblings and brothers and sisters. But my God, did they have differences?
Yeah. Well, you have that, and then you also have the dynamic of the kids and the parents, which comes out somewhat later on when Josh, who you've already identified as impulsive, trades his father's beloved tobacco, and you already set up that, you know,
yeah,
that Stuart really, really looks forward to having a little tobacco at the end of the
day.
Well,
it's his single luxury.
Yeah, yeah. And he trades it for a fox hat with Rene, the fur trader, for a fox hat with a tail. You traded it. You traded it for what? You traded my tobacco for that damn hat. I'm sorry, Pa. Pa stormed toward him as if he were going to strike him. And Scout typically gets positioned between the two and lies there kind of whining. Pa temporarily frozen, his tracks just shaking with anger. His eyes darted back and forth between Josh and me before slowly relaxing his stance. Josh, that wasn't your tobacco to trade away, son. That was mine. You're going to have to work off what you owe me. Do you understand? But he doesn't strike him, and it's a reasonable punishment, I think. And, you know, again, I was wondering if you were modeling good parent-child relationships here.
Yes, I think so. Josh is a little too old to be spanked, and Scout was simply trying to broker a peace between them, that Scout didn't want Pa to hit Josh, and Scout knew that Josh had stolen the tobacco. Scout was just simply trying to broker a peace so they could come to a compromise, which they did. And Josh readily accepted his punishment. He realized that it was wrong, it was stupid, it was impulsive, as you said. And so for the next several weeks, he's working off doing not only his chores, but he's doing multiple chores for other people because he's working off this.
Yeah, I guess he was getting paid and then paying back his father for the tobacco or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And later on, Sarah trades the hat for a mess of watercress.
Yes.
Because they all probably crave greens.
Well, Sarah did. Sarah's...
And you ask in your study guide, you ask why she's not punished when Josh is. And I wonder if you're, you know, if this is this sexism or is this what did you want your young readers to get out of that?
In both cases, Pa is the disciplinarian, not Ma. Ma steps back out of the way. And I think that it's realistic to assume that I had son and daughter, and I realize that they're not disciplined the same. Mm-hmm. That particularly from the father, they don't discipline their daughters the same way they discipline their sons, and I think that's understandable. I think that's human nature. And also the fact that what Josh had stolen specifically from his dad to buy something for himself, whereas Sarah stole the hat from Josh, but she was buying vegetables for them, for the family.
To share for the family.
And
yeah,
she shared with the family.
I think
Sarah had gotten sick and tired of eating nothing but beans and dried beef.
Yeah, they probably really craved greens after the diet they had on the trail.
Well, particularly, you know, Sarah, and I'm sort of portraying Sarah as a modern girl. She's in the 19th century, but, you know, she's trying to eat healthy, whereas the rest of the family wasn't quite so concerned. And she traded the greens with an Indian girl. And the Indian girl, she didn't want the hat. She wanted a blanket, but they weren't willing to separate a blanket, you know, trade a blanket. But the Indian girl took the hat.
Yeah. Well, you already kind of mentioned that Scout is heroic, you know, in almost every chapter.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was partly, as you say, because you remember those old Westerns?
Yes.
All right. One of the most heroic moments is that passage that you like to read to kids. Did you want to read that now?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can read that.
Okay.
All right. This is the Great Bear. And remember, when it says I refers to Scout the dog.
Yes, yes. The dog is telling the story.
The dog is telling the story. Mama, I heard Sarah say, can Molly and I go look for berries? Yes, Ma answered. Take Scout with you, and don't go too far. I'll need your help for supper soon. I sprang to my feet. I was tired, but I was still up for doing whatever I could do to help the family. Watching the girls hunt berries was a lot easier than hunting with Josh. Josh would travel several miles on foot tracking a deer or an elk, but the girls would rarely leave sight of camp. The girls grabbed their baskets, and with me trailing behind, we headed first downstream and then up a small tributary. Once I realized the direction they wanted to go, I took the lead. I didn't want them surprised by a snake or any other dangerous situation. Several hundred yards up the small creek, the ground leveled off into a green marshy meadow. Trying not to get wet, the girls tiptoed across the water, using stones whenever possible, and then up the opposite bank. I began to worry that they might be getting a little far from camp, but still not so concerned as to stop the girls from exploring. On the back end of the marsh, the girls hit pay dirt. A large thicket of berry vines ran up from the water's edge up a jagged hillside. Holding their dresses to avoid catching them on the thorny vines, the girls waded into the briar patch and began picking. Soon the baskets were getting full of fresh mountain berries, and I just sat in the sun and watched. Suddenly, I caught the scent of something in the air. At first, I wasn't sure what it was, but the scent was strong, and I wasn't sure it was good. I stood looking in the direction I thought the scent was coming from. Just then, I caught sight of two black fur balls coming down through the pine trees towards us. I could now hear them rolling and tumbling down the hill in our direction. Bears, I suddenly realized. Worse yet, bear cubs. That meant their mother couldn't be far behind. I had never actually seen a bear, but I knew what bears were, and I'd seen hides on walls of several trading posts, and I'd heard stories. I'd also seen bear heads attached to those bear skins, and I knew the bear's mouth was full of teeth, teeth I didn't want any part of. I barked to warn the girls, knowing that my bark would also inform the mother bear of our presence, but there was nothing else I could do. Sarah looked up at me and said, "What is it, Scout?" I barked several more times, hoping the girls would understand before the mother bear arrived to defend her cubs. Molly, looking around, finally saw the cubs and said, "Oh, how cute!" Sarah grabbed Molly's hand and started heading out of the berry patch, but it was too late. The mother bear came crashing down the hill towards the marshy meadow. I frantically raced to put myself between the girls and the mother bear. I began barking furiously, hoping that I might scare the bear off. But more importantly, I was hoping that I would bring help from camp. I admit I was scared. However, I couldn't let the girls know that, for at that moment, their lives depended on my bravery. Sarah froze in fear, but Molly dropped her basket and ran screaming towards the camp. I was afraid the bear would start to chase Molly, so I lunged in the bear's direction. She stood her ground, just growling at me. I could hear Molly crashing through the brush as she ran towards our camp, screaming at the top of her lungs. The bear didn't chase her, so I knew I had to stay with Sarah. I slowly backed in her direction, barking and showing my teeth, just as the mother bear was doing the same. It was a standoff, and I only hoped it remained that way until help arrived. Moments later, Molly's screaming stopped, and I assumed she had made it safely back to camp. The next 2 or 3 minutes were the longest of my life, as the bear and I just stood there growling at each other. To my relief, I soon heard Josh racing towards us. As Josh entered the clearing, I glanced over at him to see if he had the rifle. He did. I breathed a sigh of relief. I knew it would take a perfect shot to kill the bear. I also knew that Josh only had one shot. I backed up closer to Sarah to protect her in case Josh's shot missed. She was shaking in fear, which stiffened my resolve to protect her. Josh was still maybe 40 yards away, and I'm sure he was just as scared as we were. He raised the rifle and fired. My heart stopped as I looked towards the bear. Josh's shot had missed.
And that's where you stop when you do the reading for the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, well. And speaking of stopping, we are up on another break already.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Wittliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Wittliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Wittliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
Ready, San Marcos. 104.1 KZSM presents the second annual San Marcos Music Awards. Become a member today and nominate your favorite San Marcos music artists, venues, and more. Nominations are open till Monday, January 13th, and members-only voting is open January 15th through the 19th. Finalists will be voted on by the public January 21st through 28th, and the San Marcos Music Awards ceremony will be held on January 31st at the historic Price Center with the red carpet starting at 6 p.m. Come show your support for our local music scene as the community names this year's winners of the SMMAs. General admissions includes 5 food and drink tickets, raffles, giveaways, vendors, and VIP packages available. Sponsored by Listed San Marcos, the Price Center, Gumby's, Big Man Kitchen, Miracle Leaf, Kip Massage, Twin Liquors, and What's On Your Mind Design. Tickets and memberships available at kzsm.org/smma.
Speaking of the San Marcos Music Awards, we are right here on Bookmarked, and I am holding in my hand 2 free tickets, which if you can get by our studio in the next 20 minutes or so, 216 North Guadalupe, you can have them. And we are taking a wonderful journey along the Oregon Trail with Scout of the Oregon Trail with the author Todd Krickmer, and there's a lot to talk about. But one of the really important things is the relationship with the people we would now call indigenous, but of course in the book they're called Indians because that's what they would have been called. And did you, just as a quick question, I warned you about this, did you choose 1852 because that was the year when the most travelers took the trail?
Pausing for the fire truck.
Yeah.
Yes, I hope we're not on fire. No. I originally was not going to say 1852, but there is a scene where Josh chisels their name on a rock and he dates the rock, so I ended up selecting 1852. That was the year, the highest year of migration, mm-hmm. which was just a coincidence.
Yeah.
But
it makes sense. And also, it is also before hostilities broke out between the Plains Indians and the U.S. Army. So the relationship with the Indians depicted in the book are mostly friendly. You have, and I won't take the time to read the scene right now, but you have that lovely scene when Josh shoots a deer and then he and Scout encounter 3 young Indian braves who also claim the deer and may also have shot it as well. We're not sure. And they finally, with some tension, agree to and divide the deer. And there's tension. You also point out that the 2 Indians are about Josh's age or younger, the 3. And was that important?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, these are teenage boys, and mm-hmm. they are working out. They both are armed, but mm-hmm. they're very likely have shot their only shot. These are muzzle-loading rifles.
Right.
And so if they both shot, both guns were unarmed. And so even though they both had a gun, they were going to have to work this out among themselves because they didn't know that the other one's gun was unarmed or not.
Yeah.
And so they worked it out with Scout intermediating because there were 3 Indians and there was just Josh and the dog.
And that was part of the argument that they thought there were 3 of them, so they should have more of the deer.
Right.
Well, that's reasonable enough. You have Mrs. Churchill make a speech to Molly that I thought was maybe what you wanted the reader to take away. They're on when they're on their steamboat. It's Sarah. She makes the speech to. I'm sorry. When we pass Indian villages, the children run to the riverbank to wave at us, and their dogs run along the river's edge. But their parents and the other older Indians do not even look at us. Do you think they're mad at us? Sarah, I think they're worried. They're concerned about all the changes we have brought to their lives. I don't think they're mad at us, and I don't think they hate us. I think they're troubled by the changes they see us bringing to their way of life. They don't understand it, but they know there is nothing they can do to stop it.
It yeah.
Seems almost ominous
yeah.
in a way for them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Plains Indians at that era, they thought the white settlers were just passing through,
mm-hmm.
and all they wanted to do was trade.
Yeah.
They were desperate for manufactured goods, particularly yeah. cloth, but any kind of tools. Of course, they wanted guns, but you know, any sort of tools, and they didn't realize that the whites weren't just simply passing through.
Yeah.
That came about in the 1860s and 1870s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you have that, and that comes out in the scenes that you have
mm-hmm.
Between the travelers and the Indians. Molly is bitten by a rattlesnake, and again, sort of assisted, saved by Scout.
Well, Scout tries.
Yeah.
Didn't quite get there in time.
Yeah, the Lasseter, the wagon master, takes her to an Indian village where a medicine woman treats her successfully, it turns out. And I was wondering where one of the things that she does is she puts Molly in a cold river, which I was thinking that would make sense because the cold would slow her circulation so that she wouldn't absorb the poison as fast. I wondered how you came up with the treatment, or was that just sort of creative on your part?
Well, I attempted to, this was already in the outline of the story, and so when I got to that part writing, I looked up Indian treatments for snake bites,
mm-hmm.
and lo and behold, I could not find any. Mm-hmm. There were no known Indian, they simply just relied on medicine man, mm-hmm. you know, dancing and whatnot. Well, that wasn't going to work. So I went to as many, I Googled and researched as many as I could. I had trail guides.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a trail guide of the 1850s written by Army officers, and they suggested the cold water.
Mm-hmm.
And the tobacco is a common, I read that several places where tobacco was a common treatment, put a wad of, chewed up wad of tobacco on the wound. And apparently there is scientific evidence for that to actually work, that helps. Mm-hmm. The tobacco, I'm not sure what it is in the tobacco, but it has a way of sucking out or neutralizing mm-hmm. the poison. So we used all those things. I used the cold water. She didn't suck the poison out because that apparently doesn't work. But
she makes
this little cut. She puts it in cold water, lets the cut bleed in the cold water, and then she packs it with a herb and the tobacco.
Yeah. And that seems to
be because and they went to the Indian doctor because Mr. Lasseter said, I've never seen an Indian die of a snake bite. That's just his personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they were too far to get to an American doctor. There was an American
right,
doctor,
okay.
but the closest American doctor was 2 days away.
Yeah, yeah. The depiction of women in here, the Wikipedia article on the Oregon Trail says, and it's kind of there's kind of two contrasting views that seem to go on at the same time. While women experienced many deaths and hardships on the trail was also a place for women to take on roles they had previously not been allowed to take on back east. And you really kind of do both of these. Maddie's dress catches on fire in the campfire, which probably happened, in those dresses.
For women that weren't used to cooking over a campfire.
Right, I was thinking of that. You know, you'll be moving around, you'd be trying to grab the pot.
And you had a dress down to your ankles.
Yeah. So they started wearing bloomers, which apparently actually happened as well.
Yeah, well, further west,
yeah.
you know, they
yeah,
would eventually.
Yeah,
right.
not right away. And you also have Stewart point out that in the homesteading that they'll have like 640 acres because the second 320 will be in Maddie's name. And he says, you know, okay, if anything happens to me, she'll have her own land in her own name and be protected, which is important. On the other hand, there's a woman whose child is injured and eventually dies. You know, I just realized I missed an important question. But tell me about women on the trail, and then I'll ask the a kind of important overall question.
Well, of course, when you're making a trip like that, you all have to work together. And obviously, the woman is no longer a housewife. She's a valuable part of the team
mm-hmm.
that all the children have to help. You know, I mean, Molly mm-hmm. got bitten by the snake because she was going to get water, which was her chore.
Yeah.
And, you know, Josh has to tend to the animals, and Sarah has duties too. They all have to work together, and it's not like they're back at home.
Mm-hmm. particularly if this is a middle, you're right, particularly if this is a middle-class housewife,
right,
who might very well not have been.
Well, she had
a stove. Of course, Maddie
was
a farm wife. So
she was a farm wife, but she may have had a stove back home.
Yeah, knew how to
she didn't have a stove now.
So, okay, the hard question is the kind of, if this is a book for kids, it's the balance between painful. I mean, Lasseter says at the beginning that he's never lost anybody, but two people die. The little boy who's been injured, an older woman, presumably of just
exhaustion.
Exhaustion and fatigue. A baby is born at mm-hmm. about the same time. But bad things happen. Unscrupulous ferry operators and, you know, try to prey on people. There are arguments. There's tension. There's, you know, dangerous animals. There's weather. So how did you strike a balance between kind of making a hopeful story, we got to get there, and dealing with these really, you know, painful, dangerous realities?
Well, we discovered when we were driving the trip that an approximately 300,000 people made this trek between the early 1840s until 1869. 1869 brought an end to the Western Trails mm-hmm. because the railroad was completed. But over that period of time, an estimated 300,000 made this trip. Well, 30,000 died. Because it was a dangerous trip. Obviously, it was dangerous. Yeah. And the 30,000 that died, that's only 10%. That means 90% of the people made it.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to strike that balance. But when kids are playing the Oregon Trail game on their computer, almost everybody dies. And that's not true.
Oh, really? I knew there was a game, but I didn't look at it.
Oh, yeah. Well, the game's sort of a, yeah. And it's just a game for kids to play on their computers. But it's where you pack their wagon yourself, and you pack your supplies, and then you head out on the trail, and boom, you're out of this or you're out of that, and everybody catches dysentery and dies. Well, it's not that bad.
I think I want to play that one.
Yeah, don't play that game. But the point was that, yes, it was very dangerous, and yes, people definitely died, particularly mm-hmm. of cholera. Most of them died from cholera, which I skipped in the book because I Googled cholera, and it is just so disgusting. It's so awful.
Oh yeah, we didn't, and you have the wagon master saying we'll start early to avoid this.
To avoid.
Presumably because the longer after all these people have gone by, the water sources get polluted, and that's
correct.
How the people get cholera.
And he didn't know that, but all he knew was the sooner you start, the better.
Yeah.
That's what he knew.
Yeah.
Because they didn't know that cholera was a bacteria, and they didn't know it was spread by poor sanitation, which mm-hmm. it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I was trying to make the point that it's extremely dangerous, but 90% made it. And I mm-hmm. didn't know that until my wife and I drove the trail,
mm-hmm.
and it was mentioned numerous times. 90% made it.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point to end on then. You are writing another book already? What is it?
Well, the sequel. I'm doing a sequel for each of the three kids.
Oh, okay.
So I'm on Josh's right now.
Oh,
so okay. Josh had a little romance when he was on the trail.
Yeah.
He met another girl.
Are you going to continue the romance? He was also, when they were at Fort Laramie, there was another soldier who was kind of trying to get Josh to join the Army, which Maddie didn't like at all.
No, Maddie did not like him joining the Army.
Yeah.
That's another nod to the 21st century. But
yeah.
Yes, he did not join the Army.
Mm-hmm.
He does go off to find. He ultimately gets a letter. Once they're back in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
he does get a letter from Rachel and mm-hmm. renews the relationship. And so he's off to California to find her.
All right. Any last thing you want our listeners to know?
No, I just certainly appreciate this opportunity. I've enjoyed talking to you, Priscilla.
Oh,
thank you very much.
I have enjoyed talking with you. And so Todd Krickmer, author of Scout of the Oregon Trail, the story of an American family traveling the Oregon Trail in 1852, as told by Scout, the family's dog. Highly recommended, available Amazon and other places. All right, so thank you again, Todd Krickmer. And as always, thank you for listening.